describe the format. First of all, we'll be starting with two opening statements. Rabbi Kahana will go first, followed by Rabbi Axelrod, after which there will be an open session for questions and answers from the audience. Now, we have a mic set up in the middle of the floor right there. We ask that you not line up behind the mic. Rather, I'd like people to raise their hands and I will pick people to ask questions. It sounds like a funny setup, but we have a reason for it. A lot of people are here tonight. I see the place is absolutely full, and I know there are going to be a lot of people who are going to have questions for either speaker. Because of that, we are really going to have to insist that people make their questions very, very brief, to the point, and in the form of direct questions to one or the other or both speakers. If people get up and read manifestos, we all love manifestos, but I'm going to have to say, please don't do it, because there's just no time for it, and it's not fair to everybody else. Okay, I guess that about covers everything. By the way, I feel at this point that that it's appropriate for us to thank also the administration of Brandeis University. In fact, not every university would allow an event like this to occur, and I think it says a great deal for those in the Brandeis administration who are involved that this event is happening tonight. Thank you. So without further ado, I'll turn the floor over to Rabbi Kahana. Thank you. In the past year, two great things have happened to me. Two great dreams have come true. One, I won a seat in the Knesset. The second thing has happened tonight. I'm debating Rabbi Axelrod. It's been a long time, and I think it will be an evening in which we'll hear two sides. Two sides. And you can hear those sides and think about them carefully and decide for yourselves, because no one has the right to bar any Jew from speaking. And no one has the right to decide who may speak and may not speak. And therefore, this evening, after many, many years, you'll have an opportunity to hear two distinct views of Judaism and decide. And when you have, act. Because the most obscene thing in Judaism is apathy. So whichever side you choose, become active in it and work for our people. I'd hope, really, that this would be a debate in the same way that I had one with one other noted Jewish figure in Boston, in the sense of having specific questions asked of both parties. Unfortunately, it didn't work out in that way. Perhaps the next time we appear, we'll have a debate. Since we're fairly limited in time, I think that what I would like to speak about is the role of a Jewish leader. What is a Jewish leader? What are the stands that a Jewish leader must take? One, I think, and the first one must be, that a Jewish leader must be honest. Without honesty, you have nothing. Without honesty, you have fraud and hypocrisy, and you can never build on that. And therefore, I would hope that in terms of honesty, when anyone will quote from a Jewish source, and when anyone will come and bring a Jewish source to his defense, that the honest question asked must be, do you believe that that source is divine? Because if it's not divine, then why are you bringing it? What makes that source right then? I'm going further, and I'm saying honesty for a Jewish leader who speaks about Judaism compels that leader to speak about a Judaism which God gave. Otherwise, who cares about it? Otherwise, it has no greater bearing upon proof of truth than any other wise or wisdom written by wise men and wise women. So when someone hands out a flyer, the Torah says, what does that mean? It was written by wise people and wasn't from God. Who cares what the Torah says?
So in this debate, when two Jewish leaders will quote from Torah sources, from Judaism, honesty compels you to think and ask, do you really believe that that's God's view? Did he give it? If he didn't, it's a non sequitur. Then quote Plato, just as good as Judaism. Or quote Jesus, who was also human. Honesty. Honesty compels a Jewish leader to sit down and ask himself, why be Jewish? A person who believes in universal values, in all human beings being equal, a person who believes in that and then says, I'm a Jew, will automatically set up barriers between Jews and non-Jews. The moment you say, I am something, anyone else who is not that thing is outside of there. Why set up barriers? Why not simply be human? Let us be human beings. It's not this nonsense about being Jewish or Catholic or Buddhist. There are wonderful human beings who are Buddhists, Muslims, and Christians. Why be Jewish? Unless you believe that the Jewish people stood at Sinai, that it really happened, it isn't some story. That there's a real God, not the God who is a spirit within man, like indigestion. But there is a transcendental being who made us and who appeared at Sinai before a Jewish people and gave us the one thing no one else has. What is the one thing that no one else has? Is our blood different from that of Gentiles? Of course not. Is our skin different? Of course not. Are we smarter than Gentiles? I want to break this news to you just very, very gently. There are some smart Gentiles. That's not what makes us different. The only thing that we have that no one else has, the only thing that gives us a reason for being different, for saying I'm a Jew and not a non-Jew, is Torah. Is divine law. And if it's not divine, well, then our book is as good as theirs. Honesty. Honesty. If someone cannot say that being Jewish is special because we have the truth, what reason can we give to our children not to marry someone who's not Jewish? What reason can a Jewish leader who doesn't believe that this is divine? Oh, he may play games with it. Yes, it was a revelation, not really a revelation, but it was a kind of a revelation. What reason can he give to a Jewish student who comes and says, Rabbi, I've met this really good-looking girl, and she's really, really smart, and she's nice, and she's not Jewish, and you don't have to be Jewish to be nice. There are a lot of nice non-Jewish girls around, and boys. Rabbi, tell me why I shouldn't marry someone who's nice and clever and pretty just because she's not Jewish. Honesty, honesty. A rabbi who gets up and speaks about racism as being one of the most terrible, if not the most terrible things in the entire world. Is there a greater racism than telling a student, don't marry her? Why? Because she's not Jewish. Honesty. You know why we've lost so many young Jews? Because young Jews are among the most perceptive young people, young children are among the most perceptive creatures that God has ever made. When their parents send them to a Hebrew school, a temple school, and the child comes back and says, you know, the rabbi said that Jews don't eat meat and milk together. And the parent says, well, you don't have to listen to everything the rabbi tells you. That child, though he or she be 8 or 9, has registered. My parents are phonies. They may not show it. It is registered. Children can spot fraud immediately, hypocrisy. They perceive,
They have a built-in radar system. And they can spot falseness and fraud in a parent, in a teacher, in a rabbi. Of course that's why they leave.
Honesty. That's the question. Rabbi, why be Jewish? Why not be a human being and march for South Africa? Not as a Jew, but as a human being. Or march for Soviet Jewry. That, of course, may be a little bit tribalistic, but let's march for South Africa. Honesty. Without that, there's no Jewish leader. Without that, there's no Jew. The second aspect of a Jewish leader. Assimilation. If ever there was a red line, a bottom line in the Jewish people, if ever there was a thing which though the Jew violated the Sabbath and did not eat kosher and violated everything, there was always a bottom line, intimate. That's the bottom line. No, not that. And I remember when in 1946, Henry Morgenthau, the Secretary of the Treasury under Roosevelt, became head of the UJA and married his second wife who was not Jewish. He was forced to resign as chairman of the UJA despite the fact that he had a great many contacts. Because despite the fact that most Jews were not Orthodox Jews. That was the button. No, not that. Anything but that. Who ever heard of a rabbi marrying a Jew and a Gentile? Who ever heard of such a thing? With that marriage, what you do, despite all the protestations, despite all of the rationalizations of mixed marriage and the rabbi, a rational alternative. Written by Rabbi Axel. Despite all the rational, when you perform that marriage, what you are doing, you are taking the swine and marking it kosher. Whereas if every rabbi would stand firm, and on this issue, whether it makes no difference whether you're Orthodox, Conservative, Reformed, or gay. The fact is, if every rabbi would stand firm and say, no, that's the bottom line. That would get a message through to young Jews. Everybody is so much opposed to it. And that's got to be something that maybe I shouldn't do. When you perform the marriage, what you've done is you've stamped the Hechsher on it. It's kosher. My God. If the grandparents of the rabbis that perform these marriages would get out of their grave today and see what their grandchildren are doing, they'd go back to the grave. We destroy our children by not telling them, no, no. There is something that far transcends your particular personal need of love. There is a Jewish people, and you're part of that people. And how dare you break that link of 4,000 years, that this chain of 4,000 years. How dare you? You aren't an island unto yourself. You're part of the Jewish people. You have an obligation. And I would never... How dare you come to me and ask me to become part of this national suicide? You want to marry her? Marry her. But no. Live with guilt. You broke the chain. You broke it. That's a Jewish leader. That's a rabbi. Tragedy of so many rabbis who, because of pressure from wealthy congregants and trustees whose children want to intermarry, give in to that pressure and then rationalize their reasons for so doing. Jewish causes. We are now in the midst of was the base over Bitburg and the Holocaust. How Jews love to attack Goyim. Oh, no. Oh, they love it. Let's get Reagan. Of course, what Reagan did is an obscenity. This muddle-headed empty vessel. But far more painful to me than anything that Reagan could ever do about the Holocaust is the tragedy of the Jewish establishment during the Holocaust in America that knew about it and did nothing. That's what should pain us. That's what should drive us. There's a scarlet letter on the Jewish breast. We knew of the Holocaust long before the war ended. We knew of the Holocaust as early as 1942. Where were the Jewish leaders and where were the Jewish groups who in years to come would march for every other cause in the entire world under the banner of Tikkun Olam? Tikkun Olam. We must reconstruct the world. Jews who marched for Angela Davis, who studied here. Jews who marched for every cause in the entire world, every non-Jewish cause and every anti-Jewish cause. Stokely Carmichael. I spoke here in Brookline a few months ago. Every Jewish leader in Boston came out to pick at me, including Rabbi Axelrod. Farrakhan spoke here. Good. Let's wait for the punchline. Farrakhan spoke here, and if Rabbi Axelrod went out to picket him, I'll apologize. He didn't. With now you can help. I want to know whether a Jewish leader, a rabbi, has the obligation to be the first to be arrested for Soviet Jewry. I want to know why, when two of your students were arrested, Soviet Jewry, these are the heroes. These are the heroes of the campus. How many rallies did the Jewish leaders of Brandeis hold and get arrested for Syrian Jewry and Ethiopian Jewry, and they're black? I want to know why it is more important for a Jewish leader to get arrested for South Africa than for a Jewish cause. For 50 years, no one marched for Soviet Jewry. For 50 years, it was Jewish leaders who cared about every other cause except our own. If a quarter of a million Soviet Jews got out finally from 1968 to 1980, it was because there were Jewish leaders who said, for Jews, Jewish interests come first. I don't want to get into South Africa. It's a racist regime. It's abhorrent. A terrible one. But what do you think will take its place when Rhodesia went under another racist regime and it became Zimbabwe, and the black government 3 months ago voted in the UN to expel Israel, as did Nicaragua? I have an obligation to march for people who want justice, when I know that when they have power that they'll try to do away with my Jewish state? What, am I insane? You want justice? Fine. You want justice? You had better give justice. If not, march by yourselves. In the 1950s, when Algeria was fighting for its freedom, Not the slightest doubt. The French were imperialists and colonial, not the slightest doubt. The Arabs there were absolutely right. They wanted freedom and they had an absolute right to their freedom. Should I have marched for them? Should I have marched for them so that when they got their freedom they would turn and demand that Israel be wiped out? Jewish leader marches, he first has to march not with his feet, but with his head. For whom am I marching? Who are my people? What am I marching with? Waiting for the day that the Hillel director, Brandeis, will be seen marching off to jail in Boston for a Jewish person. And as a rabbi who has done that once or twice, let me tell you, Rabbi Axelrod, it's really not so terrible. You're in and out. What else does a Jewish leader call for? A Jewish leader calls for the recognition that the state of Israel is the center of the Jewish people, and that it is the obligation of the Jewish people to live in the land of Israel. The incredible, the unbelievable attempt to create a new Jewish concept, equal coexistence with the diaspora, which is such a mealy-mouthed word, the galut, exile, that's the word that once was used until the Brit jumped on it and changed it. The galut, chutz la'aretz, outside of the land, is the term used in the Talmud. Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel. This last Passover, you celebrated the Seder. I'm not talking about the freedom Seder. The real Seder. God didn't give Passover to Gentiles. Indeed, no. Rabbi Axelrod certainly knows that a Gentile who attempted to bring the Paschal lamb was killed. Not a very nice Torah. What can one do here in the hands of the extremist rabbis? Now, the Seder. We celebrate two things on Passover. The freeing of the Jews from bondage and the bringing them out of Egypt to the land of Israel. You think that God came to the Jews and said, I'm freeing you and now you will go to Waltham or to Great Neck? I shall bring you out of the land of Egypt to the land of Canaan, a land flowing with milk and honey. There's a purpose to create a special Jewish people in a special Jewish state, because if we live as a minority among the Gentiles, the majority non-Jewish culture will influence us and change us so that we end up with rabbis just as we have. Judaism is not a religion that calls for the admixture of Jews and Gentiles. Every Moshe Shabbat, the Jew rises, raises his cup of wine in the ceremony of Havdalah. You know what that word means? Havdalah. More enough people. The Jews of the Soviet Union don't have the students at Columbia and Cornell to take over Hamilton Hall. The only ones that the Jews have are those few handful of Jews who care. People want to march against nukes? Let them march against nukes. There will be enough to march against nukes. But there aren't enough to march for Jews. And that preacher who just yelled won't march for Jews. For Jews, Jewish interests come first. For years in this city of Boston, elderly Jews, poor Jews in Mattapan and Dorchester and Roxbury were terrorized by hoodlums. What did the Jewish leaders do? You think that there was anyone who cared here? The Jewish leaders fled to Newton Center. You think that the Hillel director went and said, my God, these poor elderly Jews, what can we do for them? No. We were busy advising Angela Davis here. When Alma Lewis, under the threat of burning down a yeshiva building unless she was given it for $1. Did anyone here protest? Does anyone care? The Jews, the Jewish interests of Boston, were the Jews of Dorchester, and not Alma Lewis. For the Jews of Brooklyn, for the Jews of Great Neck, their problem was the Jews of Brooklyn who didn't have the money to move to Great Neck, but who were stuck in Brownsville, East New York, and the South Bronx. And believe me, that's no pleasure. Elderly people, frightened people, terrified people. It was the JDL that went in for them, and in return, you were called hoodlums and fascists by people who never gave a damn for them. I'm sick and tired of a federation, a Jewish federation, raising money from Jews for such Jewish causes as a Jewish hospital. Jewish hospital? There's no such thing as a Jewish hospital. All people get sick. Jews, Catholics, Protestants, thank God, atheists, everyone gets sick. You don't raise money for a Jewish hospital. A hospital should raise money the United way. Jewish money should go for the most important of all things, Jewish education. That's the most important thing. And if that's tribalism, long may tribalism live. Because that's the only way that the Jewish people will survive. And finally, the Jewish leader cares about the death of Shealtiel Akiva. There may be one person in this entire room, including those on the stand here, who know who that person is. Shealtiel Akiva was born 21 years ago in Rosh Ha'ayin, a Yemenite town just outside of Petah Tikva. I was at his funeral, 2.5 weeks ago. He was a soldier, but he didn't die in Lebanon. You see, we all have to leave Lebanon, no question about that. He didn't die in Samaria. We have to leave Samaria. But he didn't die in Samaria. And he wasn't killed in Judea. Even though we have to leave there, because then there will be peace. Shealtiel Akiva was killed by Israeli Arabs, our Arabs, good Arabs. As he stood 5 kilometers away from his town hitching a ride, he was picked up by Arabs, Israeli Arabs, and murdered. You heard of his name? No, or maybe one did. Was there anything mentioned here? Did the advocate tell you? I don't know, perhaps so. Maybe it does advocate certain Jewish things. Does anyone here know the name of Moshe Tamam, a 19-year-old soldier murdered while hitching a ride near Netanya? His eyes were gouged out and his sexual organs cut off. Did you hear about that? And David Bukra, a soldier, 19 also. His body was found in pieces. Esther Ohana was murdered the same week that Emil Grunzweig was. Most of you have heard of Emil Grunzweig. No one has heard of Esther Ohana. She was murdered by a rock thrown through the car in which she was riding by Arabs. I don't hate Arabs. I love Jews. And I have no intention of sitting by my brother's blood. And in this week's portion, you'll also read, Lo tamod al dam re'echa, thou shalt not stand by thy brother's blood. And all those people who speak about ethics and morality, and we have to live in peace with the Arabs. I would love to live in peace with the Arabs. I would love them to live in their country, and I in my country, in peace. And for those Jewish leaders who write such things out, what Kahane has done with the values and ideals of our heritage is a revolting, repugnant story. All right? A revolting, repugnant story. Tell it to the Jews of Rosh Hashanah. Tell it to the Sephardic Jews of Israel who don't learn about Arabs through a seminar at Brandeis, but who learned about Arabs by living with them, by living under them. Tell it to the Sephardic Jews of Rosh Ayin and Chatzor and Kiryat Shmona. Tell it to them. They know what it means to live under Arabs with coexistence. And they never again, never and never again do they want it. That's why my support comes from them and not from college professors. In the next election, there will be mass suicide among the Jewish leaders of this country when they see how many votes I get. I want to finish by speaking to you as a rabbi, a real rabbi, one who believes that God gave us a Torah, a divine Torah, that the words there were written by God. I want to read to you what Judaism really says. Of course it speaks about peace. The question is, with who? With who? Gidola nikama shenitna bein shtei otiyot Hashem. Great is revenge. Great is vengeance. Bear in mind, this is not Kahane speaking. God, I'm a moderate. I would never say such a thing. Great is vengeance. Since it was placed between the two names of God, Shenemar, as it says in Psalms, Kel Nikamot Hashem, the Lord, the God of vengeance. That's from the Talmud in Rachot 32, and those who put out that flyer can now write that down too as notes. In speaking about Pinchas, the famous Pinchas, the Kohen, who murdered a Jewish man and a Gentile woman for having sex together. Did I should ever think of such a thing? It says, what he did was, Vayechaper al Bnei Yisrael. He atoned for the children of Israel. And the rabbis asked, Yechi Korban, did he then sacrifice a sacrifice? That it says atone, one atones by bringing a sacrifice. What did he do? Ela elamedcha, but to teach you. Shekol hashofech damam shel rishayim keilu hikriv korban. One who sheds the blood of the wicked, it is as if it was a sacrifice. For all of those who upset the things that I say, and who worry about the Arabs, concerning you, did the rabbis tell us, Kol hamrachem al harzar, sofo liot arzar al harachman. One who has mercy on the cruel will someday be cruel unto the merciful. Ki teitzei lemilchama al oivecha. When you go out to war against your enemy, the Torah recognizes a war. The Torah recognizes a war that is called a milchemet mitzvah, a war of obligation. That's not Kahane. That's Judaism. And here is what the rabbis tell us, and I conclude with this. On the verse in the fifth book of Moses, when you go out to war against your enemies, the rabbis say the following. If you have mercy upon them, then they will go out to war against you. Mashal, and they bring an example. Leroeh, a shepherd. It was a Jewish shepherd. Shaya roeh sono bayar. He was shepherding his sheep, his flock in the forest. Matzah gur echad shel ze'ev. He found a little tiny wolf, sick, weak, dying. Hamalala. He had pity on it. What doesn't a Jew do? He has pity on every wolf. He had pity on it. Vaya meniko ben ha'izim. So he nursed it with the goats. He gave it milk. He gave it milk. Baba melachto, his employer came and said to him, Matose, what are you doing? Kill him, he said. Harogoto, kill him. Shelo tiye takala latzon. Otherwise, he will cause tragedy to the sheep. No shama, no. No shama. He didn't listen because he was a humanist. A humanist after his course. Poor wolf. Poor Arafat. Poor wolf. Kivan shegadal, when the wolf grew up. Akeves, he saw a sheep. Poor goat, he killed it. Gibi, a little goat. Ochlo, in. Ate it up. Amarlo, his employer said to him, Lo amarfi lecha, didn't I tell you? Lo, tachos alav, don't have pity on him, kach amar le Moshe, so did Moses say in the Torah, Bamidbar, the fourth book of Moses. Imatem chasim alehem, vaya asher totiru mehem, those that you will leave in the land out of pity, the sikim, they will be as thorns in your eyes. Itzahu etchem al haaretz, and they will persecute you in the land. Asher atem yoshvim ba. The halacha decrees. It's in the Talmud. It's in the Rambam. Maimonides, who is quoted here. In this particular thing, Maimonides is quoted. He is quoted as saying that one must feed and clothe the poor Gentiles for the sake of peace. Yes, he says that. Now listen to what else he says. You can take notes so you can have a complete Torah. The Rambam says in the Law of Kings, he speaks about the question of a Gentile who lives in the land of Israel. What is his status? And he declares that the status is that if the Gentile wishes to live in Israel, he must accept two things: misin v'avdut, taxation and servitude. Now that's a sifri in the Talmud. Now the Rambam comes and he defines what is servitude. I am reading this to you word for word. Word for word. V'avdut sheyikablu, and the servitude that they will take on themselves, who is sheyu nivzin, that they shall be humiliated, ushfelim and low, mimata below, the lo yarimu rosh klal b'Yisrael, and they shall not raise their head up in Israel, ela yukvushim tachat yadam, they shall be conquered under them, the lo yitmanu al Yisrael, and they shall never be appointed over Israel, Mishum davar sheba'olam, to any kind of a position ever. If you want to argue with me Judaism, I'll be overjoyed. But honesty should compel the person who is doing so to ask himself, am I as much a Talmid Chacham, a scholar, as the other guy? If you want to argue with me about ethics and not Judaism, that's more honest. And don't bring in Judaism. And talk about ethics. And then ask yourself, what kind of an ethical state is the state of Israel now, which has a law of return that applies to Jews only and not that? What kind of a state is that? How many Arabs do you think love the state of Israel? Coexistence with a state that declares itself the Jewish state? If you were an Arab, would you be happy with that state? How many Arabs do you think get up and sing the Hatikva, their national anthem, happily? With the words, Nefesh Yehudi Homiya, the soul of a Jew yearns. They just break down in tears over that. On Yom Ha'atzmaut, last week, Independence Day, how many Arabs rushed out into the streets to in merriment to celebrate their defeat? I don't hate Arabs, but I know that if the Arabs stay inside Israel, In 10 years, we'll have a Northern Ireland. And in 20 years, there'll be a majority. Is that what you want, a majority of Arabs? There's a problem. There's a contradiction between Western democracy and Judaism and Zionism. Zionism calls for a Jewish state. Western democracy says, whoever is the majority, the majority. When 61 Arabs sit in that Knesset, you think that they'll allow Israel to remain a Jewish state with a Jewish law returned? You think so? Of course not. There'll be a vote, and 61 Arabs will vote to change it, and 58 Jews will vote no. Yossi Sarid will abstain. He's not sure. My friends, we live today in an era. The Messiah is coming. We have it in our power to bring him. Be Jewish. Be Jewish. Come back to being Jewish. And I repeat you what I said when I was here last. This summer, take off from Brandeis. Take off from everything. Go to Israel. Not to a kibbutz, God forbid. Go to a yeshiva. Go to a yeshiva and learn what being Jewish really is.
To thank Rabbi Kahana very much for his speech.
Stop. Thanks. No problem. Thank you, Rabbi Kahana. Father and Father Roth, my friends. I want to add my thanks to Bob Carroll's, to the organizers of this evening's program, for their toil and efforts in making it to be. I want to also thank Bob Carroll for agreeing to moderate tonight's program. And I want to thank the university and its various constituencies for hosting the program. This is truly a debate, whether my colleague calls it that or not. It's a debate in the generic sense, if not in the technical sense. We are arguing, and you'll see for yourself in a short while how very different our points of view are. If that's not a debate, I'm not sure what is. So let's proceed with the debate. A press release that went out within the last couple of days describes me as a left-wing rabbi. We're in my preface now, by the way. So as a left-wing rabbi, I want to wish you all a happy May Day. Today is May 1st. May Day is a workers' holiday. And in the face of the exams and the papers that you all are going to be confronting, you certainly qualify. So happy May Day to you all. And for you faculty members who are here, and quite a few of you are, I want to remind you that our tradition is proud of describing us as Rahmanim b'nei Rahmanim, compassionate, children of the compassionate. Remember that when it comes to grading these many people here. Not to give them charity, we don't really have such a concept in our tradition, but we do have compassion. Lots and lots and lots of compassion. In my remarks, and also in responding to questions, to continue my preface, when personal attacks emerge, I simply will not dignify them. So there will be things that I won't respond to, not in the course of my remarks, not in the course of my answers to questions. Their affairs instead should prevail, and if I can help, it will. I will not, to continue my preface, I will not impugn my colleagues' love and loyalty for Judaism, for the Jewish people, for Israel. I know he loves Judaism. I know he loves the Jewish people. I know he loves Israel, as I do. I would consider him misguided, perhaps, but certainly not a self-hater. Lastly, by way of preface, I must comment that, unlike my colleague, I am not a seasoned debater. Rather, what I try to do, in ways my own, is to softly speak truth to power. I remind you, my friends, that a variety of notorious perpetrators of evil in the world were known to be powerful orators and skilled debaters. They appeal less to reason, less to rationality, but to emotion. They try to incite base emotions, jealousy, hatred, hostility, anger, insecurity, fear, paranoia, superiority. Don't fall prey to that. Think for yourself. In the end, however, my choice of teachings stands independently of him, and I'm proud of it. On an individual level and on a collective level, for us as individual Jews, for us as the Jewish people, it seems to me our primary need in life is to have not wealth, not power, but, as one of our Holocaust survivors has said over and over again, I refer to Viktor Frankl, what we need is purpose, purposefulness, purpose which transcends the self. I recommend to you Frankl's book. In my humble opinion, it's one of the most important books of our century. And this purpose should affect your choice of lifestyle, of career, of everything. And what is Jewish purpose? What is Jewish purposefulness, both for the individual Jew and for the Jewish people? It is, first and foremost, Kiddush Hashem, that is, sanctifying and hallowing God's name, conveying this through one's words and deeds, conveying the holiness of God, the unity of God, the notion that we Jews have only one absolute transcendent boss, capital B, only one ultimate ruler, capital R, sitting on the throne, not the state, not even the state of Israel, no false gods, only Adonai, the Lord. We bend the knee only to Adonai, like Mordecai, like Hannah and her children, like the Jewish martyrs, even if this means civil disobedience, arrest, and death. Kiddush Hashem, sanctifying the divine name. Secondly, it has to do with Tafiyat on Israel, this Jewish purpose, the survival of Judaism and of the Jewish people in all of its manifestations as a transnational people spread throughout the world. And I'm proud of the diaspora. It's a wonderful term. And the nation state Israel. Ours is not to be like others, many of whom equate manhood with muscle and with macho. That's not the Jewish way, even if we can find psukim here and there that will point to it. Ours, rather, is to be God's witnesses in the world, God's edim, God's partners, God's shutafim. Ours is to be mamlechet kohanim b'goy kadosh, a nation of priests and a holy people. We are God's instrumentality, chosen or elected not for privilege, not for prerogative, not for superiority feelings, but for responsibility. And when God demanded, I'd rather you save the clapping altogether because it'll cut in on my time, and then Bob Carroll's going to slip me a piece of paper saying you have only 5 minutes. So that should come out of your time, not my time, please. And when Adonai demanded of Pharaoh through the lips of Moses, Shalach et ami, let my people go, that wasn't the whole of that pasuk, the whole of that verse. The rest of it is v'ya'abduni, that they serve me. Our purpose is not simply to be free. Our purpose is not simply to exist. Our purpose is not simply to be in Israel or wherever. And by the way, that phrase v'ya'abduni, that they serve me, God, referred not to Israel, but immediately it referred to the desert, that the Israelites serve God in the desert, not in Israel. That we serve God everywhere. That is our purpose. So first, Kiddush Hashem. Second, Tachiyat Am Yisrael. And third, an occasionally maligned term that is really a very sacred term, and that is Tikkun Olam, repairing and bettering the world, striving and struggling through means of justice and righteousness and peace and love, in partnership with God, as God's shutafim, to build a just and peaceful and harmonious order, paving the way for Mashiach Tzai, for Yemot HaMashiach, for the Messianic Day, which we may never witness in our lifetimes, but which we nonetheless must help inch closer, however imperceptibly. Now these purposes and responsibilities, they're to be carried out by each of us individually and as a people. As individuals, we must each decide how and where. Each of us must decide that privately. How and where. The how, I would suggest, ought to have to do with Jewish learning. And there are some very good yeshivot that I would recommend to you, but not indiscriminately. They're not all good. And if someone tells you to go to a yeshiva, be careful. Don't just go to any yeshiva. Choose a real good yeshiva and ask some very hard questions before you enroll in just any yeshiva. And yeshivot are not the only places. There are lots of others, including, by the way, Brandeis University. So Jewish learning and Jewish practice and observance and celebration and Jewish activism. And as for the where, it doesn't really matter whether it's in Israel or in the diaspora. The Jewish people, after all, may once upon a time have conceived of ourselves as a circle with one center, but Jewish tradition is not and was never meant to be frozen once and for all time. And I think it's a mistake for us to view ourselves that way today. And it's been a mistake for us to view ourselves that way for many a year now. Rather than view ourselves as a circle with one center, if we must resort to the mathematical idiom, and that's not exactly my field, as those of you who know me know well, we are perhaps more of an ellipse with numerous foci, with many centers, all of them co-equal. Israel and the diaspora are indeed co-equal fronts in the struggle for Jewish continuity and Jewish survival. And so I urge you, be at home and affix your mezuzah in either of the fronts, wherever your soul and wherever your spirit are most fulfilled. But wherever that is, be a Jew. Kiddush Hashem, Tzviat Yisrael, and Tikkun Olam. Be a Jew in what is, whatever for you, a serious and a maximalist way. And don't let anybody legislate that for you. Come to terms yourself with it. Decide for yourselves what that means. Decide for yourselves how to be a Jew, where to be a Jew. You can be at home anywhere. You can stand tall as a Jew anywhere. You can be a fulfilled Jew anywhere. If you elect to be a diasporist or to settle in Israel, just be what Samson Raphael Hirsch, one of our greatest leaders, called a Yisroel Mensch. Be a Yisroel Mensch. Be a Jewish human and be a human Jew. Support the continuity of Israel as a people, as a state, in all ways, including criticism, and struggle for a just and peaceful world. Now it follows that there are two kinds of love for which we Jews are responsible. There is Ahavat Yisrael, which my colleague likes to emphasize over and over again, to the exclusion of anything else. There is Ahavat Yisrael, love of Israel, of the Jewish people, and that's vital. But so is Ahavat HaBriyot, love of all of God's creatures, love of humankind. In this vein, the rabbis extolling the virtues of Aaron, Moses' brother, and elevating him to the role of modelhood precisely because he was, quote, a lover and pursuer of peace and a lover of all creatures, Ohevet HaBriyot, who sought to bring them near to the Torah, that is, to the law of God. That deserves to be kept in mind. It is no accident, as we Jews have realized for centuries, that our Torah begins not with the first Hebrews, and not even with the first patriarchs and matriarchs, and not with the emergence of the Jewish people as a nation, but necessarily with universe, and with Adam, Adam, meaning earthling. Our heritage concerns itself with both the commandments given to Israel and the commandments which are binding on the human family, the children of Noah. The biblical prophets, like Amos and Jonah, they chastise not only Israel, but the neighboring nations as well for wrongdoings and waywardness. And Amos compared God's providential concern for Israel with divine intercession in behalf of others, like the children of the Cushites and the Philistines. One of the Talmud's compendia of the very essence of Judaism focuses on that verse in Genesis which reads, "These are the generations of Adam, Eleth Hodot Adam," suggesting that concern for humankind has been the very essence of Judaism from its most incipient stages. And the rabbis taught that even the Torah itself was intentionally given not on the soil of the Holy Land, quite conspicuously, as one might have expected, but at Sinai, necessarily in the desert, in no person's land, that it be the property of all. And comparable citations abound throughout our tradition, most notably, for example, in the Torah portion that we just recently completed, a portion of Shmini, which many of us find less than exciting and less than inspiring. It is the Torah portion that includes the laws of Kashrut, including the swine, the pig, about which, by the way, my colleague might have told you that there is a midrash that suggests to us in no uncertain terms that one day the pig, the chazer, is going to be kosher. Not that Torah law will change, but that the chazer, the pig, the swine, will become a ruminant. It will one day change its character and chew its cud. And if there's hope for the pig, then who knows for whom else? But I didn't mean to talk about the pig. What I did mean to talk about, and if your laughter is born of the assumption that I was trying to suggest that anybody in this hall, God forbid, is in my mind or in my opinion a pig, nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing at all could be further from the truth. So instead of focusing on the pig, what I did want to focus on was the stork. The stork, it turns out, is one of the trait fowl. The stork is forbidden to us Jews. And in the Hebrew Bible, the stork is called, in the original, the Hasidah. Now Rashi raises the question, following the Talmud in Kulin, Rashi raises the question, Lama nitra shema Hasidah? Why is the stork called a Hasidah? After all, a Hasidah means a righteous one. And the answer provided by Rashi is, She'osa Hasidah im chaberotaha im zanot. That the stork, or the chasidah, does kindnesses and is compassionate with others of her species and her friends with regard to food. That is, she provides food for the others of her species. Now, Nachmanides, the Ramban, explains to us that birds, fowl, are labeled unclean. Nachmanides raises the question, why are fowl declared trait? What makes a bird unclean? And Nachmanides' answer is that what makes a bird unclean is cruelty. Birds are unclean because of their cruelty. As Nachmanides said in the original, "V'hinei ta'am isur ha'ofot mipnei achzariyut." Lo and behold, the reason that birds are forbidden to us is because of cruelty. And so, along comes the Kutzker Rebbe. In Cain, if so, Sha'al Rebbe Mendel of Kutz, asked Rabbi Mendel of Kutz, Lama hinech shevet ot kameh? Why then is the stork considered an unclean animal? After all, the stork deals kindly with others of her species. And the Kutzker's answer is, She'osa chesed in chaberoteha, the rocking chaberoteha. That she deals kindly with the others of her species, but only with the others of her species. So much, I think, for the kind of particularism that we've heard tonight. To preach only Ahavat Yisrael, only love of Israel, is, if you will close your eyes for a second and put yourselves in another country and in another generation, would be not unlike saying, Jews, Israel, Wilbur Ellis, overall. Someone else did that once upon a time, and we know the results. Never must we have anything of that sort again. Not from any people, especially not from us. He committed then. Be committed then to the causes of our people, and be committed to the causes of humankind. Be involved in Soviet Jewry. Be involved in Ethiopian Jewry. Be involved in Israel's security. Be involved in nuclear disarmament, and in the overthrow of apartheid, and in resisting American imperialist aggression in Central America. I admit that in my case, as a rabbi and as a Jew, I'm frankly downright proud of my record and of my activist commitment to Israel, to the pursuit of Israeli Arab peace. I'm proud of my visit and of my continuing involvement in the cause of the refuseniks and my visit to the Soviet Union and my interaction in Moscow and in Leningrad with the refuseniks. I'm proud of my involvement with Beit HaYisrael, Ethiopian Jewry, as I am of my commitment to nuclear disarmament and to the other causes. However, what matters very much are our activist tactics and our strategies and our methods. Tzedek Tzedek mandates the Torah, justice, justice shall you pursue, according to which the rabbis instruct us that justice is to be pursued not by violence and not by injustice and not by unrighteousness, but only by means of justice. Moreover, with regard to Soviet Jewry, for example, we know now very well, unless we choose to ignore facts, that violence and confrontationalism, they just don't work. We know now that Soviet repression and oppression, the denial of exit visas to our brothers and sisters, all of that goes on in a much more protracted way under Cold War. Soviet Jewry has it worse under Reagan. Soviet Jewry had it best under détente, with harmony and normalization, relatively speaking, in the winds throughout of all years, the Nixon years, and early in the Carter administration. Thus, I urge you to pursue Soviet Jewry liberation by striving for détente. Getting arrested may be wonderful for headlines, and it may be wonderful for one's sense of heroism, but it may not help Soviet Jewry today. So I urge you to use your heads, and not to get swept up in rhetoric or in what looks heroic on the surface of things. As it turns out, what just might help Soviet Jewry today, among other things, might be your pursuit of the nuclear freeze and of harmonization of the relations between the Soviet Union and the United States, aside from that being best for a troubled and threatened world. Let me shift gear now and talk about Israel's security and Israel's survival. Time, it seems to me, is against us. In time, the superpowers will impose a settlement on us, and it may not be a settlement that will favor us at all. In time, too, the Arabs will gain on us technologically. Not fast, but eventually. In continuing rounds of warfare between us, our people, and the Arab states, and the Palestinian people, our cousins, continuing rounds will be ever more costly, not in guilt, the money's not important, but in blood. And I care about Jewish blood, and I care about our cousins' blood as well. And what's perhaps most dangerous of all, eventually, we just may lose one of those rounds of war. And then what? Now, we must be militarily prepared and strong. I would be the last person to argue for Israeli disarmament unilaterally. I would argue for Israeli disarmament after the Arab states have disarmed. But the road to security and the road to survival of our beloved Israel is not through strength and not through reliance on might. The road to survival is through coexistence and through normalcy, through a just peace with the Arab states and with the Palestinian people, according to which self-determination of all parties must be accommodated, not at the expense of one another, certainly, God forbid, not on the grave of one another, but self-determination of both must be accommodated. We now have a Jewish state. It may not be as large as some of us would like, and it may not be according to what the Torah record has it that God promised us. I think that in good time, God will take care of his or her promise. It doesn't have to be today. It doesn't have to be immediately. In the meanwhile, we're stewards over a very difficult situation. We have a Jewish state, and the Palestinian people, whether we like it or not, must cease to be themselves dispossessed and stateless. It's not for us to tell them that they must settle in one of the other Arab states, any more than it is for them to tell us where it is for us to settle. They deserve statehood as we deserve statehood. And so we must maintain Israeli strength and Israeli preparedness, of course. But we must offer to relinquish all conquered lands, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip. We must do that not unilaterally and not fast, but we must offer to do it within the ultimate context of a real peace, of recognition, of non-belligerency, of normalcy. And we must proclaim our readiness to allow for independent Palestinian statehood, not on our graves, but side by side with us. And as for Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, which is for us the holy city, Ir HaKodesh, we must remember that it is that also for the Arab peoples, our cousins. They call it Al-Quds, as we call it Ir HaKodesh. They call it the Holy One, as we call it the Holy City. That it may not be of the same magnitude as Mecca or Medina is irrelevant. It is for them a holy city, as it is for us a holy city. And so I propose, ultimately, that within the context of Jewish statehood and Palestinian statehood side by side, Jerusalem never be divided, but that it be a dual and shared capital. That is the road for peace. Now, what we could care about could be one of two things. We either want territory, aggrandized, expanded territory, without peace, or we're prepared to relinquish territory and have peace. We can't have both. We must choose one or the other. And ultimately, God will find the divine way of fulfilling the divine promise. For now, we must pursue the road to peace, which is just in itself, and which is the key to true security and true survival. Now, speaking of Israel, let me shift gears just slightly and discuss the subject of the maintenance of the Jewish nature of Israel, so very important to all of us. Of course, it's really important that Israel remain a Jewish state. That's not up for grabs at all. But we must be concerned more, I think, with quality than with quantity. Israel must be a state, if it is to be a Jewish state, that represents in the world Jewish values and Jewish ideals and Jewish teachings. It's less important how many Jews live there, and more important what Israel says to the world, and how Israel represents in the world the will of God. In what way is Israel a model state in the world? But let me speak also about quantity, about population. The only thing that I believe my colleague and I agree on 100% is that the Jewish birth rate deserves to be increased. He and I have done our share, I think, in equal terms. But I would urge all of you to take very seriously that command in the book of Genesis: be fruitful and multiply. Peru, Uruhu. It's everywhere. But let's talk more also about Jewish quantity in Israel. If we're really interested in Jewish quantity, Perhaps my colleague ought to consider the prospect of departing from the tradition in some ways. After all, again, I say, it was never meant to be frozen once and for all time. And perhaps we ought to be, instead of shaking the fist and intimidating non-Jewish folks in Israel, perhaps we ought to be trying to interest them in Judaism, particularly those non-Jews who are already married to Jews. Perhaps we ought to be reaching out to them and interesting them in our tradition. He stated accurately that I have a controversial position on mixed marriage. I'm not going to go into that now. If there are questions about it, I'll very gladly respond. But suffice it to say now that there's only one reason for my controversial position. That is, for my taking the position that if it is lucidly clear to a rabbi that a Jewish family life is going to result and that the children are going to be raised actively and exclusively as Jews, not in a smorgasbord of Judaism and some other tradition, then I believe that we rabbis, except for those of my colleagues who are Orthodox and who are therefore locked into a system that they can't budge from and that they're straitjacketed, but the rest of us, conservative, reform, reconstructionists alike, if we're interested in the survival of our people, we ought to be considering a selective approach to mixed marriage and performing mixed marriage ceremonies, not the normative Jewish ceremony, but creating an alternative ceremony, which would be part one to the normative Jewish ceremony, when we have clear reason to believe that a Jewish household and Jewish children are going to result. And then at a later time, if conversion, formal conversion as it's called, does occur, then part two would occur, namely the normative Jewish ceremony. More about quantity. We should, of course, consider from a quantitative approach relinquishing all of the conquered territory, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, because certainly if we maintain it, the Arabs will outpopulate us, outnumber us in a relatively soon, quick time. And we must consider all sorts of ways of increasing the educational level and the professional and occupational opportunities of the Arabs of Israel on the basis that with greater education and greater professional opportunity come fewer children, which unfortunately has been all too true of us of the Jewish people. And I would go on. I would urge, there you go, there's Bob Carroll, that we not be so paranoid of Arabs outnumbering us in mainland Israel. There is no incontrovertible statistical basis for feeling that way. So don't be so quick to absorb someone else's paranoia. More, we ought to go out of our way in Israel, and I would invite my colleague to participate as an active leader in this, in establishing Jewish religious pluralism in Israel, and in establishing peace with the Palestinians and the Arab states, so that Israel will have greater and more magnetic appeal to us diaspora Jews, if indeed Israel wants Aliyah from the diaspora. For example, Israel ought to go out of its way to be hospitable to reform and conservative Jews, with an eye toward attracting such Jews to Israel, if Israel really wants our numbers. We must create conditions in Israel furthermore, conditions having to do with peace, which would then allow Israel's economy to get into control, that would lower the exit rate from Israel. The exit rate is what also causes problems for the Jewish population of Israel. But one thing for sure we must do. We must banish the altogether evil thought of expelling the Arabs, because Israel is their home too. And to think about expelling the Arabs is unmitigated evil, no matter what a halakhic text may have said at one time in our history. I ask you once again to close your eyes, my friends, and think back to another generation and another country when there was a leader who spoke of his country being Judenrein, free of Jews, no Jews. It's not so unlike that for a Jew today to speak of Israel being Arabrein, free of Arabs. We know what happened once upon a time. Never, ever must we tolerate that again. Not anywhere in the world, certainly not in our people. For the moment, the Arabs, not the Arabs of Israel, but the Arab states and the PLO, the Arabs are the enemy. That's abundantly clear. But the question should arise in your minds, how does our tradition relate to the enemy? How ought we treat the enemy if we are being loyal to our tradition? And I would like to share with you some elements that my colleague neglected. He shared one element about vengeance. He neglected to tell you that it's also a mitzvah not to bear vengeance, lo tikhon, the lo tikhon. But let me share with you some other selections about the enemy. The book of Proverbs, Sefer Mishlei in the Bible, teaches us, Ma'aneh rach yashiv chema, a gentle answer, a soft response, turns back anger. And the Talmud, echoed in the prayer book, and those of you who daven regularly will remember, that at the end of the Amidah, in a silent little meditation there, we speak about those who curse at us and who are our enemies, and we say, V'lima kalalai, and as to those who cuss at me, nafshi tidon, may my nefesh, may my being be silent, be quiet. And that same book of Proverbs goes on to say, rejoice not when your enemy falls, and let not your heart exult when he stumbles, lest the Lord see it and be displeased. And the Talmud in Baba Matzia teaches us, if two claim your help and one is an enemy, help him first. Centuries later, an 18th century Hasidic master, Rabbi Michal, taught this command to his sons, and I quote, pray for your enemies that all may be well with them, and rest assured that far from opposing God's will, these prayers of yours, more than any others, will be in God's service. Relations with and treatment of the enemy aside, the major question to us is posed by that ancient text, Avot the Rabbi Natan, where the question is raised, Ezehu Giborish of Agibori, who is the mightiest among the mighty? And the response in the text is, one who makes of his enemy his friend, one who converts his enemy into one's friend. That, my friends, is the measure of Jewish strength. Not muscle flexing, not overpowering with the fist. Those are the ways of other people, and let's not be Hellenist Jews about that. But rather converting the enemy, in this case the Arab states and the PLO, into our friends. And that can be accomplished, obviously enough, only through moral and spiritual and political means. Ours is not to expel the Arabs, not to oppress them, not to repress them, not to intimidate them, whatever may have been said centuries ago. Ours is to reach out to them, to respect them, to accommodate their needs, to convert them from the status of enemy to that of friend. That's the Jewish thing to do, and that's the tactical thing to do. And that will lead to security, and that will lead to survival. As for aiming violence at one's enemy, and as for engaging in violence at all, I'll be honest with you, and I will present a more whole picture than my colleague. It is true that violence is mandated in our tradition, and anyone who denies that would be dishonest. I would never dream of that, certainly not intentionally. And so we know that with regard to the individual, if one comes to kill us, we are mandated to defend ourselves, if need be, by killing that one first. Haba lahor gefa, hashkein lahor go. One comes to kill you, get up early and do it first. But our tradition teaches us that we are to exert only the level of violence necessary, and not more than that. If more than that is exerted, if one kills where one could have injured, then that one is culpable. And yes, about collective violence, that too is mandated. Not permitted, but mandated. When the very existence of Israel, of the Jewish people, is under attack, of course a war of defense is mandated. And of course that's called Milchemet Mitzvah, or Milchemet Chovah. It is an obligatory war. But the weight of our tradition, though ruling out sheer pacifism, if by sheer pacifism we mean turning the other cheek, the weight of our tradition seeks to restrain and to limit violence, even in war. And my colleague might have presented that, but probably lacked the time. Even in war, limits are set. And so there's a ban, for example, on cutting down the fruit-bearing trees of the region. There's even a ban on surrounding a city on all four sides from Rambam, from Maimonides. So that's at least one side be left open for people who wish to escape. According to Torah law, in the book of Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, soldiers are ritually unclean. They are tameh. They are impure and unclean after battle. In fact, they had the highest degree of impurity, comparable to one who touched a corpse, and they therefore had to undergo purification, the purification process, remaining outside the camp for 7 days, washing their war garments and cleansing their bodies ritually. Participation in war constitutes ritual defilement, and let's not forget it. Violence is not our way. It simply is not our way. If we want to ape other nations, then let's be clear that that's what they're doing. But it is simply not the Jewish way. On Yom Kippur, we stand in shul, those of us who go, and we engage in the public confessional, the Al Faith, which is an alphabetical acrostic in doublet or couplet form. And what do we say when we get to the letter Chet? You remember? We say, Al Faith Shechatanu Lefanecha B'Chozek Yad, for the sin which we have, or for missing the mark, God, against you by strength of hand, Chozek Yad. And coupled with it is what? And there could have been lots of other missings of the mark with the letter Chet. But what did the author choose? The Al Chet Shechatanu Lefanecha, and for our having missed the mark against you, God, by what? By Chilul Hashem, by desecration, by profanation of the divine name. Precisely the opposite of the concept of the spare about having to come up again. And I thank you very much for being such good sports and such good listeners. I want to remind you, as I sit down, not to relinquish your Jewish birthright. If you're going to pursue the way of the sword, the sayyid, if you're going to pursue the way of the fist, if you're going to pursue the way of hatred and superiority, be clear, that's not our way. Be clear you're aping someone else's way. Instead, let me remind you, my chaver and chaverot, that you are Rahmanim b'nei Rahmanim. You are the compassionate children of the compassionate. You are Rodfei Shalom. You stand under the mandate to pursue peace wherever you dwell and wherever your feet take you, anywhere in the world. Be true to the Torah. Be true to God's law, all of whose paths lead to peace. V'chol nativoteha, Shalom. Love Israel, the Jewish people. Love all of God's creatures. Be Yisrael, mentioned. Be human and humane Jews. And be Jewish humans. God bless you.
Of course, according to the format of the debate, you have the option of specifying your question for either Rabbi Axelrad, Rabbi Kahana, or both.
Galut is not a term I would use anymore. Once upon a time, I would have, when I was a lot younger, but no longer. What I advocate for the individual Jew is to live wherever he or she chooses, wherever his or her soul and spirit are most fulfilled, but wherever that is, to be a Jew. To me, it matters not where one lives. However, when I spoke about Israel making life, Jewish life, more attractive for the non-Orthodox Jew, I was trying to advise Israel as a friend in court, as a friendly compatriot, and as a partisan and lover of Israel,
what Israel might do if Israel is really concerned, as is my colleague, about Jewish numbers. Nothing more, nothing less than that. So I advocate Aliyah for those whose souls are going to be most fulfilled in Israel. And I advocate the diaspora for those whose souls are going to be most fulfilled in the diaspora. And what I urge upon you is wherever you settle, wherever you put your mezuzah up and be Jews, be Yisrael nation.
Before I ask this question to Rabbi Kahana, as a member of the Hillel staff, I would like to respond back to some of the Christian friends that I have here, and I do it personally as well. I would like to quote the following. And have a response to it. If a man does all the commandments in the Torah, but he has not created peace, then he has done nothing. Mishnah Rabbi Elazar. How do you respond to that accusation about human delight in addition to the following? Quote, Jewish Press, Friday, August 31st, 1984, we do not call people to make a decision to fight fellow Jews and to, quote, burn out these people from our midst. And could you also explain why my teachers, who gave me rabbinical ordination at Yeshiva University, an Orthodox institution, and who are among the greatest authorities in the East today, find your philosophy and everything you stand for to be despicable? As a fellow Orthodox rabbi, I accuse you of ignoring the essence of what the Torah has always stood for, compassion and respect for the dignity of all human life. And I ask you how you can support an organization in Boston that, according to the Boston police and numerous testimonies, terrorizes fellow Jews, including faculty and students on the Brandeis campus, my own friends and students, by defacing their property, physical assault with stones, several death threats. This is not politics, this is madness. And finally, one final question. In Omaha, Dad, September 23rd, 1984, you lost the violent overthrow of the state of Israel that you have 24% of the population behind you. I reveal these things not to speak to you. You are too far gone, to understand. I do it to reveal the real audience of what you really are.
I think that I could have easily just come up here and said that if you're not interested in my answer because I'm too far gone, then you had a moral right not to ask the question. I am convinced that you would have never used that kind of language if a black anti-Semite would have been here. You should be ashamed of yourself as a rabbi for using the kind of language if you did. Now I'll answer your question. Going backwards. I'm always impressed by people who read a magazine, one of them, which is known as one of the most vicious and notorious anti-Orthodox magazines, a radical leftist one, and you say it said it, therefore it's true. I'll tell you, the quote is not true. All right? The quote is not true. I think that someone who claims to be an Orthodox rabbi, who quotes from a magazine which is so viciously anti-Orthodox, because it suits him, has been a little bit of soul-searching. I don't know what group you're talking about. Any group that attacks Jews is a group that doesn't have my support. That takes care of that. As far as rabbis from YU, there are rabbis from YU that think that what I say is wrong. There are rabbis who think that what I say is wrong. I would venture to say that you're a Zionist. I would venture to say that you're an American Zionist, one who does it from America. You're a Zionist. If I came to you, and if you had been living in 1900, and you would have known that the overwhelming majority of leading rabbis were against Zionism, you would change. feeling as I am. Things that I've said have led to deep conflicts among rabbis. Don't come to me and ask me why the rabbis say it. Come to the rabbis and say, Muhammad wrote this quote and this quote and this quote. And answer it. It was not kind of a debate. It's not the same kind of a debate that I have here. This is a debate between an Orthodox rabbi who believes in the Torah and a rabbi that doesn't. But in this case, this rabbi doesn't believe in halakha. He doesn't believe in halakha. He says, once upon a time, there were laws of war, but now it's different. Rabbi Axelrod is honest. So he's the first one to admit that he doesn't follow the halakha. You, I hope, do. So therefore, when I come, I would hope that you would argue as a Talmud Chacham instead of that obscene statement that you made. Talmud Chacham takes the quotes and the sources that a rabbi brings and he deals with the sources, with the quotes. Don't insult me, answer me. Those who can debate, defend. And labels are the last refuge of non-thinkers.
Every Hezder yeshiva boy serves either in the tank corps or in the Tzanchanim. They're all in army fighting units. The kibbutznik also does. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the Jewish content of the kibbutz. There are Druze who fight in fighting units. Would you encourage our people to go and live for the summer in a Druze village? I'm speaking about a Jew who goes to Israel, as Rabbi Axelrod said, for the Jewishness of it, the Jewish content. I'm not particular. I don't see any great Jewish content in a kibbutz which isn't kosher, where there's no Sabbath, where usually there isn't even a bit Knesset. I'm talking about the fact that a young Jew should go to Israel for the spirit of Israel. So what kind of a non-sequitur is that, that people in the settlements, in a kibbutz, serve in the army and serve well? They do serve in the army, and they serve well. So what? What does that have to do with where you should spend the summer? Spend the summer in a yeshiva, which sends its students to the army, where they also serve well. My son is in the army. My son-in-law is in the army. They fight well, and they study well. They wear the yarmulkes proudly under their helmets.
I'd like to ask the next question before Rabbi Axelrod. Sure.
There you go. I don't know if I can say that particularly to my rabbi, Dolan, but and I don't even know if you can answer this question, but if you can sit with me for days and days and you can stand up there and talk about being Jewish. I don't know how you talk about being Jewish when you advocate intermarriage. You talk about how can you raise a Jewish? You said in the first 5 minutes you said be a Jew, and then later on you said be fruitful, multiply, because that's how we're going to further our Jewishness. And then you said that I marry a non-Jew and a Jew because hoping that the saying that you've accepted that the house has become Jewish. How do you know that? We have enough trouble with Jewish homes having Jewish homes. How do you know? How can you say that? The first question should be what yeshiva was sent to, not what religion we bring them up in. I'd also like to ask you to answer if you can. I don't even know if I want to answer because I don't know if I can accept anything you said. The same way that Rabbi Goldberg said that you're far beyond to answer the question, I'll give you the opportunity. At the same time, I want Rabbi Nahana to
be. Don't be emotional.
I would like to also have a comment on that.
Well, if I did the comparing, how could he answer? Oh. But you're wrong. I didn't see. My answer was going to be I didn't compare him to Hitler. I'm comparing things he's saying to things that someone else said. That's different from comparing him to Hitler. All right. And as for mixed marriage, my answer is going to be very brief as well. All right. So I think that probably we'd be well advised to have that be a subject in and of itself, because it's of sufficient importance rather than be a parenthetic aside in a long evening. But I'll say this to you in all honesty. It doesn't make me happy when a Jew and a non-Jew marry. And if it were to happen to any of my children, as it happens to quite a few other rabbis, including Orthodox rabbis, by the way, and Judaica scholars, it will upset me no end, to put it mildly. But there's a bigger question here than the emotional feeling about all this. And there's a much bigger question even than the halakha of all this. Halakha is very important to some. Halakha is actually important to me as well, though my colleague may deny that. But it's very important to me. It's not that it's legally binding upon me. It's not. And it's not that it is... So I do not consider halakha to be binding and immutable. That... I honestly agree. But to say that it's unimportant to me is also wrong, because halakha has a spirit to it, too, that I believe is important, far more important, by the way, than its letter. I believe the spirit of halakha is much more important than the letter of halakha. And it grieves me, it pains me, to see the conclusions that my colleague reaches, because it seems to me that they are in gross and vicious violation of the spirit of halakha. But more about that if a question arises. Back to the issue of mixed marriage. The real question of importance is this. Not what does halakha say about it, and not what does what do our emotions say about it, important as those are, but what's going to be the upshot of it all for the survival of the Jewish people? If you're locked into a situation where you may observe only the letter of the law, that's one thing. And as my colleague is obviously in such a situation, it's perfectly clear to me why he cannot and will not perform a mixed marriage. And I respect that, and I understand that, and I accept that. From his point of view, and from the point of view of that system, that's internally consistent. And I wouldn't try to argue him out of it. I really wouldn't. What would pain me would be the question for the rest of us Jews, who do not consider the letter of the halakha to be immutable and binding, and who therefore can't object to mixed marriage because the halakha bars it. Why then do we object to it? Why do you object to it, for example, unless you're a halakha observing, a letter of the law observing Jew? Exactly, because of Jewish survival. Bingo. You object. It's my turn now, then. You object to it precisely because of Jewish survival. That is, mixed marriage, you're afraid, will weaken the survival of the Jewish people. It will attenuate our survival. Well, now, it is not fair to say that across the board. And if we can get to the point where we control our emotions about it, then I think we'll realize
that mixed marriage is not, across the board, a threat to the survival of our people. There can be mixed marriages, and, my young friend, I can give you lots of examples of them, because I've been here now 20 years, and I've seen them, and I have never done a mixed marriage out of pressure, never ever. There's no pressure of the wealthy class or the donor class on me. There simply isn't. And so for anyone to suggest that there is, it's an untruth. So I don't do it out of pressure, not at all. I do it for one reason, and one reason only, and that reason is the survival of the Jewish people. And that's all. Now, mixed marriage is not going to go away because we want it to go away. Not at all. On the contrary, it's not only here, but it's escalating. It's escalating all the time. And so what we have to do is learn to live with it. And not only learn to live with it, but to turn it, to convert it from a threat into something that's going to work for us, into something that's going to aid and abet our survival. And I suggest to you that that's what I'm doing by trying to get to know the couples that come my way and to figure with them whether, A, there's something good going on between them that should lead to marriage, and then, B, whether the Jewish people and Judaism will survive through that home and be passed, whether the links of our continuity will be preserved through that family. Now, sometimes it can happen in a mixed marriage. Search your thoughts yourself. Imagine the following kind of a situation, okay? Imagine the daughter, for example, of an Orthodox rabbi. Present company, of course, excluded. So imagine the daughter of an Orthodox rabbi, who is herself a very committed Jew and a very observant Jew, who happens to fall in love with a non-Jewish person. It just happens. It is, after all, a kind of an open society, and it could even happen in Israel, where she might just fall in love with a Muslim. It could happen. And they come to me, and now let's flesh out this hypothesis. Imagine that the non-Jewish partner is not a practicing Muslim or Catholic or Protestant, not at all, but is what he considers to be a free-thinking, eclectic humanist who is interested in us and interested in our culture and is interested in learning about us and in getting exposed to our way of life and is committed to all that and to having children raised actively and exclusively as Jews. Well, now, that's the kind of couple that I would want to draw near, that I would not want to alienate, not at all, that I would want to draw closer and closer to our people. And that's what I think it's all about, and that's what I think I'm trying to do in my position. So my position is not a radical position. It's not the kind of position that suggests that every mixed marriage, that a rabbi should perform or conduct every mixed marriage that comes his way. Not at all. I think there should be very tough standards. The unfortunate aspect of that is that it means that the rabbi has to evaluate every situation. That's not a happy boat to be in. It's much easier and much cleaner to have a wooden regulation, you know, a rigid rule that just cuts across all situations. But life isn't that way. And so I have to be in an evaluative position. And when it's clear to me that the Jewish people and Judaism will be served through this home and through this marriage, why then I believe it's my position as one who's committed to our survival, and for that reason alone, to be there for that couple.
I'd like to ask a question for Rabbi Kahana in the orange shirt. I met the person in the orange shirt. Yeah. Or with the orange shirt.
As the city doesn't support any groups that would attack to you. And you plan for Israel, you plan to sell the Arabs from Israel. But there are Jews who will stand by the Arabs and try to sell them, as they did, as they put us in Hebron, and in your visit to an Arab village, just follow them. So what would you do with these people? How would you deal with them?
Let's get one thing clear. The only possible way that any government of Israel could put into effect a policy of transferring the Arabs out would be if it had a majority behind it. When a government has a majority behind it and a minority goes against that, the minority is breaking the law. And therefore,
Just as in Yamitz, the army forcibly pulled out the settlers, the army or the police will forcibly prevent the minority of Jews that is breaking the law. It will stop them. Certainly won't shoot them. Certainly won't force them out of the country. A Jew is a Jew. Though he be blind, he's a Jew. What bothers me is the failure of people here to understand the threat of the Arabs and the immense contempt that we have for the Arabs. Why don't we persuade them to become Jewish? What contempt for the Muslims? What contempt? Excuse me. Now, let's get one thing clear. You ask your question, and I don't stop you, and I'll answer your question the way I answer it. If you're happy with it, fine. If not, too bad. So therefore, if you're going to stop me, I've ended my answer. Now have a little bit of manners. Don't be an extremist. If you're going to stop me once more, I'll sit down, and so will you. Now, do you want my answer or not?
I'd like to emphasize that when a question is asked, the debater who answers the question has his time to say whatever he likes in response to that question. Sir, with the hat.
In the same kind of reality, did God or did not God give the Torah on Mount Sinai to the Jews? Yes or no?
Though it says in our tradition that each of us must think of himself and herself as though, first of all, he or she went forth from Egypt and as though he or she was there at Sinai. In fact, in a spiritual sense, I was at Sinai, as I think you were at Sinai as well, but in a more temporal sense, I wasn't really there. And so it's very, very hard for me to tell you. In really factual terms, whether God did or God didn't, and I submit to you that it is equally hard for my colleagues to tell you that, though he obviously speaks with great assurance on the matter. What I believe is that God revealed a divine will at Sinai, a divine will that our people of that generation discovered at Sinai, a divine will that came to manifest itself and reveal itself to our people through all of the centuries, and that our people came to discover through all of the centuries. And that it is a divine will that reveals itself to us today too, no less than at Sinai, and that it becomes our responsibility to discover today too at Sinai. It is not something that is a frozen commodity. It is something that is in a state of perpetual development, creative development and modification and alteration. And it is for us to participate in that very sacred process. I hope you understood me.
What's a question for Rabbi Kahana?
person standing by the railing, I see you in an orange shirt upstairs.
There are many Jews who feel a personal compulsion, for one reason or another, to remain in the diaspora. Do you feel that their efforts, contribution, and their work are of any value whatsoever to the state of Israel and to its continued existence?
Whatever the compulsion of any Jew is, it doesn't transcend the halakha. A Jew is commanded to live in Israel. And what bothers me is the selective kind of quoting. A quote from a Ramban about birds. But not a quote from the Ramban about the fact that there is an obligation upon each and every Jew to live in the land of Israel, an obligation from the Torah. So of course there is an obligation. Now if you ask me, but what about those Jews who violate the law? And that's what they are doing. They are violating the law. The state of Israel was created by God's hand. The state of Israel will exist with or without the American Jew. But the American Jew will not exist without the state of Israel. There's only one reason for rabbis and teachers to stay in the exile, and that is because, unfortunately, so many Jews are here. But it's the obligation of that rabbi to educate those Jews, make them Jewish, and among the things that he should do in making them Jewish is teach them that it's their obligation to go up to live in Israel. And every Jewish rabbi and every Jewish teacher who stays in the exile should set for himself or for herself a limit, 3 years, 5 years, and then go. Because no one can ever teach someone to do something unless he or she does it too. The state of Israel did not come into being because of Harry Truman. The state of Israel came into being because of God's will and 6,000 Jews who died in a war for its independence. The state of Israel doesn't depend upon Ronald Reagan. Nothing depends on Ronald Reagan. And so for those Jews who perhaps may honestly believe that by our staying here we help Israel, no. Think of how you could help Israel if 6 million more Jews came to Israel. Think of what a country that would be. And if you're worried about money, if all the 6 million Jews came with all their money, wow, how much money. The UJA couldn't raise that in 2,000 years. And if they came with all their science and knowledge and brain power, my God, what a country we could have. So, if you want to help Israel, go there and live there. And have many, many babies. There. There. I would only hope that someone would ask a question. What is this hang-up about being Jewish if God really didn't? Rabbi Ezra, we took 5 minutes not to answer that original question. Question for Rabbi Ezra? Sure.
The question is about the Senate and is addressed to both rabbis. Israel in the Israel established by the 370 border by the UN has become a most military expert in the sense for it. Do either of you advocate being that all the way until the 367 border and why, including the Sinai, which is already given back and the beginning of that? In the Arab society, which is both reasons, why the Arab society is the reason of the peace in the 67 border now, they didn't agree to live in the 67 border before the war. Why is that? Do you think that borders do we still have the state of Israel? And such, you're putting the lives of Israel the Jews made there, you are in the sense, and it's open to suicidal. The errors which you put our lives, our fellow Jews, in their hands, were the same errors who they committed Jewish massacres before while they were living other Arab men. How can someone, while being so learned, as you outside that part, be so naive? Around the world. Iran has pretty much wiped out all of the high stakes. Okay. Everything done in the 1970s has slaughtered over a quarter of a million people left.
Excuse me, I'd like to point out that I am deciding about the length of the questions, that I'm keeping time, that I am the moderator, and no one else is. Thank you. I appreciate that there be no interruptions. I will decide when to cut off the questioner.
The Arabs in Lebanon have slaughtered 25,000. It is the civilians, the town of Kaaba itself, no more than the other thousands of Christians that slaughtered. You advocate.
Sean, can you see your last point?
Yes. You advocate letting the hands of Israel be at the people, to be at the government to advocate this violence? Rabbi Axelrod, your love for everybody has applied to you. This is the real world, not the real world.
Sean, I think there were too many points there for me to remember them all, but let's give it a shot. About the pre-67 borders being indefensible, it's not true that all military leaders and military experts agree on that. I can give you the names of some great military leaders who don't agree that that's the case. For example, Mati Peled. And, for example, Meir Pa'il. There are two, among others, who are not so convinced, as you said, that those borders are indefensible. Moreover, I'm not arguing that Israel relinquish the conquered territories of the West Bank unilaterally or fast. Only for the moment I'm advocating that Israel make proclamations and state its intentions very publicly to the Arab states and especially to the Palestinian people. That within the context of peace, we are prepared to relinquish the land. After all, when we went to war in 67, we didn't go to war in order to aggrandize our territory. We're not an expansionist people, at least not unless we want to ape other peoples. We're a peace-loving people. And so we hold on to these territories, Sean, only as a surety for peace, and for no other reason. And that within the context of peace, we will return them. And furthermore, Sean, within the context of peace, there will be no need to really defend our borders. So indefensible or not, that becomes nothing more than academic nicety. And excuse me, Sean, it's my turn again now. Whether it's defensible or not is immaterial. Once we have normalcy, normal relations, and peace. You said I was naive, so let me weave the whole thing for you, and then you can really call me naive. The kind of thing that I'm dreaming of, Sean, and that I want to see played out in our day, is that there will exist the kind of relationship that the United States has with Canada between Israel and the Arab states, and Israel and Palestine. Now, some of you are laughing. It's not clear to me whether you're laughing because you don't want something like that. I can't imagine that you wouldn't want it. I mean, God, what's the implication of that? So surely you must want it. And if you want it, then surely you must want to strive for it and struggle for it. So surely it's not out of a lack of want, but you must think that it simply isn't in the card, that it's naive to think that if there were Palestine on the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, sharing Jerusalem as a dual capital, then there could not be an Israel, that they would wipe us out. But Sean, there are a couple of other factors that I would ask you to consider. And I would add, I would also ask those of you who joined Sean in laughing, you might also consider. For one, once the Palestinian people have a state of their own, then for the first time, really for the first time, they'll have something to lose. Now the PLO has nothing to lose. Nothing at all. Give them a state, and they will have something to lose. and a state that will clearly be much weaker than our state, because we're not going to relinquish our power, our strength, we're not going to disarm. Why, we would even insist, I would think, in the negotiating process, that Palestine not have an army for however many years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever, and that weaponry from the Soviet Union or from other imperialist states, including this one, not be permitted there, and eventually not be permitted in Israel as well, but that's another matter. So that state might have a police force, of course, but not an army. Will the Palestinians agree to that? I don't know, any more than you know, any more than any Israeli leader knows. Should we make such attempts? Of course we should. If we want territories and not peace, then no, we shouldn't make such attempts. But if we're really concerned about the security of Israel and the survival of Israel as a Jewish state, then of course we must be making such attempts and such overtures. Of course we must be trying to solve this thing politically by taking creative initiatives toward the Palestinians, even toward the PLO, Sean. We should be offering to recognize the PLO. We should be offering to invite their... We should be offering to invite their leaders to Jerusalem to address the Knesset, not unilaterally, but with the precondition that they renounce terror and recognize us as a Jewish state. But there's also more, Sean, that's going on here. Not only will they then have something to lose for the first time, but they'll be preoccupied with the nuts and bolts of statehood for the first time, which we know will put on their shoulders certain other kinds of responsibilities than they now have. And finally, I would point out to you, Sean, that, and to others who smirk, that if we look around the world, we will easily see many leaders who are now respectable or quasi-respectable and who are erstwhile terrorists, who were once upon a time terrorists, including in our beloved Israel. But what happens over time? What happens over time, maybe not in all cases, but in a sufficient number of these cases, what happens over time is that once legitimacy is conferred, why then certain other that changes people, and that changes movements, and that even changes terrorist groups. And so now, if I were arguing that we do something of a unilateral or fast nature, then I would understand why some of you laugh or snicker or hiss or boo. But no such thing is being suggested, certainly not by me. What I'm suggesting is the only way for real peace and real normalcy, if that's what we want. We can't have both the territories and that.
I'm going to turn the same question over to Rabbi Kahane.
I think that for the sake of truth and accuracy, there are no great generals. There's not one great general that has said what you just told, that the borders of 67 can be supported, defended. Two people's names were mentioned. Mayor Pair was never a general. You said many great generals, and then you said Peladon Pair. So I assume that within that context, he was a general. He wasn't a general. A politician and a leftist. Maki Peled was head of the quartermaster corps of Tzahal. An important job, but hardly a great general. He is also today a member of Knesset of the Pro Ashaf PLO party. I think that those of you who heard these words weren't born, or if you were, you were much too young to recall the 3 weeks that preceded the Six-Day War. If you had been alive then, or been old enough to remember that terror, as Jews throughout the world thought, my God, Israel's going under, not another Holocaust. Jews gave money here as if we're going out of style, out of a terrible fear, another 2.5 million Jews then. Israel struck the first blow, thank God. That's what saved us. Stand on a mountaintop in Samaria, and you can see the lights of the cities of Israel on the coast. You want to go back for that? They made it. If we make this offer to them, they've gotten clever. They may agree, and we'll have given them land for a piece of paper. How many people who win five wars give up land? They may become irresponsible people once they get power. That's what they said about Hitler. That's what they said about Hitler. Of course, now he's raving, he's talking, and give him power and he'll become a responsible person. And Germany, too, was bound by a treaty that they could not have an army. He tore it up, and the world did nothing. What will the Israelis do if there is a Palestinian state which invites Russian troops in? No question that Israel will immediately march in and fight the Russians. I find it an incredible thing. Let's invite the PLO. We're angry at Ronald Reagan for not remembering what the Nazis did. How dare we forget what the PLO has done and will do tomorrow? I want peace at least as much as Rabbi Axelrod does, because I don't live in Massachusetts. I want peace because my children serve in the army, and I serve in the army. Of course I want peace. Who doesn't want peace? But there's a tremendous difference between wanting something and getting it. My grandson thinks that if you want something, you get it. When he reaches age of 5, I hope that he'll understand that that's not how the world works. Of course I want peace, but I remember the reality of the Arab-Jewish struggle. In 1947, they could have had a state called Palestine. All they had to do was agree to a partition plan, which would have created an absurd little Jewish state which couldn't have existed. And they said no to that. I remember that. And I remember what they did before there was a Jewish state. The hundreds of Jews slaughtered in what was then Palestine. Why do we have such contempt for the Arabs? There's not one Arab refugee, not one Palestinian in Lebanon who comes from the West Bank or from Gaza. You know where they come from? They come from the Galilee. They come from Haifa. They don't want to return to Shechem, because they never came from Shechem. They want to return to Nazareth. That's where they were born. Or to Haifa. That's where they were born. Why do we have such contempt for them? I respect them as a temporary step. And then you know what they'll demand? The implementation of all the UN plans. The UN resolved in 1947 to establish a state within certain borders. The PLO will demand, after they have their state within the 67 borders, that Israel conform to the resolution of 1947 and return Jaffa, or at least allow all the refugees to go back. And you know who will be the first of the Jewish moralists to get up and say, Yosha, it's only right, it's only right? You know who will be among the first? Because it's only right to let them go back, because after all, it's not right to let them stay in camps when they came from Jaffa and Rome and Luz and Ashkelon and Beersheba. No, not one inch. Not one inch back to them.
It's getting very late, so I'm going to take two more questions.
The issue that I have to get at is separatism. when babies are born as human beings. And the way that people in different societies impose their impressions upon these human beings that are born is the way that different countries create their societies, and people who are Jewish create the different sects within Judaism, and people who are in different countries create and pass on the traditions of the world. Now, what is the purpose of separating people in this sense? What is the purpose of creating differences like this? You may say that it's a tradition you want to pass on your children look like you want to bring it on, but if the bringing on brings on violence, if it brings on maybe you want to separate yourself from other people because you feel afraid of them, when you're away from other people, those people can't see the way you are. And when you're away from other people, the other people create a bias about you because they do not see what you are. If Jewish people are all in Israel, how can people who are not Jewish see what Jewish people are? They see people as there are Jewish people. There are people, you know, the way that you see it in your mind, you know, just begins to be fabrication and built up. When you see people in different countries, how do you imagine people as Africans to be? How do you imagine their cultures to be in that society? Have you ever been there? Have you ever grown up?
Can I ask you to please wrap up and specify who you would like to answer your question?
This is not just asking questions to you and you, but it's asking questions to everybody. Your purpose in really wanting to find out the discrepancies in your response, how does that affect the world?
I mean, I will give you 10 more seconds to talk.
Okay. How does this conversation affect how the rest of the world is going to respond to this? How can you, as a person, inflict your perception upon other people? It's the power and
that seems to be the way it ends up being, and that's what I thought you said. I think
that there were several parts of that question. Yeah. Yeah. And it was a good question. In fact, that was probably the most important question asked tonight. First of all, part of the question seemed to imply that if all the Jews are in Israel, then of course then Jews won't get to know other Gentiles and there'll be hatred and so on and so forth, which is why it was such a wonderful life for 2,000 years when the Jews were outside of Israel. It was just a tremendous pleasure because we got to know everybody and all of them showed us. If ever there was a society in which Jews did what you seem to want, it was Germany. The German Jew lived for one thing only, to be as good a German as there ever was. And because he intermingled and intermarried and assimilated, and there was a Jewish foreign minister, Rathenau, in 1922, and because the justice minister was a Jew, it was just, and that's why Hitler never wrote. Tragedy of the Jewish people that learns nothing from history and forgets nothing. Once you have this tremendous hang-up, how will they love us? I'm sick and tired of Jews who run around wanting love. I don't want love, I want respect. But your question was really a good one because of the fact that what you were really asking, even though you don't know it, was the question, why be Jewish at all? Because by being a Jew, you do make a difference between you and other people. And that's the question I would let someone ask that question, because Rabbi Axelrod all the time refused to answer that question. If indeed there is the great ethical,
need and goal and drive and imperative is to be a human being, then indeed let us be human beings, and you're 1,000% right. Let's stop this nonsensical Jewishness and go out into the world and stop brandizing. Let's be human beings. It's a good question. I hope that Rabbi Axelrod will answer it. Let me answer your question my way. There's a God, He has the truth, and He gave it to us. Now that doesn't make us racist. A racist is someone who says, I'm better than you, and you can never be as good as I. That's black, whites saying that about black, blacks saying that about whites. We Jews say, yes, we have the truth, and we are a chosen people. But any non-Jew who wants to is open. Take it. You can become Jewish, and you can be as good as I am. Torah is truth, and the way to achieve a status of being holy and lofty is through Torah. And that's why the Jew has to be separate, has to be different. And if there's no Torah, then you're right. Then you're right. I can understand you, and I can understand me. And both of us will have great, great trouble understanding Rabbi Axelrod. I hope that someday they won't break your heart. And I say they, the non-Jews. Because just as the German Jew was shattered, the Polish Jew was never shattered. The Polish Jew always knew that the Gentile was capable of doing exactly what was happening. He lived under no illusion. The German Jew was shattered. How could this be happening? I'm a German! I'm a human being. How can you do this to me? And the German can say, you're a Jew. If you won't learn Torah, someday you'll learn it the hard way. So when it, someday they'll persecute you as a Jew, at least get the benefits of it. Go to a Jewish school. Don't wear a brand. Go to a Jewish school. Go to a yeshiva. Find out what there is about being Jewish which is special and important, which makes you a Jewish and different and separate, and you can be separate and at the same time respect other people. You can be separate and respect them, but know that first you're a Jew.